The next LOS is to describe types of unemployment and compare measures of unemployment. Unemployment can be divided into three categories. Frictional unemployment results from the time lag necessary to match employees who seek work with employers needing their skills. Frictional unemployment is always with us as employers expand or contract their businesses and workers move, are fired, or quit to seek other opportunities. Structural unemployment is caused by long-run changes in the economy that eliminate some jobs while generating others for which unemployed workers are not qualified. Structural unemployment differs from frictional unemployment in that the unemployed workers do not currently have the skills needed to perform the jobs that are available. Cyclical unemployment is caused by changes in the general level of economic activity. Cyclical unemployment is positive when the economy is operating at less than full capacity, and can be negative when an expansion leads to employment temporarily over the full employment level. A person who is not working is considered to be unemployed if he is actively searching for work. One who has been seeking work unsuccessfully for several months is referred to as long-term unemployed. The unemployment rate is the percentage of people in the labor force who are unemployed. The labor force includes all people who are either employed or unemployed. People who choose not to be in the labor force are said to be voluntarily unemployed and are not included in the calculation of the unemployment rate. A person who is employed part-time but would prefer to work full-time or is employed at a low-paying job despite being qualified for a significantly higher-paying one is said to be underemployed. Identification of the number of underemployed is somewhat subjective and not easily discernible from employment statistics. The participation ratio, also referred to as the activity ratio or labor force participation rate, is the percentage of the working age population who are either employed or actively seeking employment. Short-term fluctuations in the participation ratio can occur because of changes in the number of discouraged workers, those who are available for work but are neither employed nor actively seeking employment. The participation rate tends to increase when the economy expands and decrease during recessions. Discouraged workers who stopped seeking jobs during a recession are motivated to seek work again once the expansion takes hold and they believe their prospects of finding work are better. This movement of discouraged workers out of and back into the labor force causes the unemployment rate to be a lagging indicator of the business cycle. Early in an expansion, when hiring prospects begin to improve, the number of discouraged workers who re-enter the labor force is greater than the number who are hired immediately. This causes the unemployment rate to increase even though employment is expanding. To gauge the current state of the labor market, analysts should include other widely available indicators, such as the number of employees on payrolls. Earlier, we noted that firms tend to be slow to hire or lay off workers at business cycle turning points. This also causes the unemployment rates to lag the business cycle. The effect can also be seen in data on productivity or output per hour worked. Productivity declines early in contractions as firms try to keep employees on despite producing less output. Productivity increases early in expansions as firms try to produce more output but are not yet ready to hire new workers. When comparing unemployment rates across countries, analysts should note that different reporting agencies may use somewhat dissimilar methods for calculating these statistics. Also, all of the employment indicators mentioned here apply only to legal employment. Participants in illegal sectors of the economy are not reflected in employment data. The next LOS requires us to explain inflation, hyperinflation, disinflation, and deflation. Inflation is a persistent increase in the price level over time. If the price level increases in a single jump but does not continue rising, the economy is not experiencing inflation. An increase in the price of a single good or in relative prices of some goods is not inflation. If inflation is present, the prices of almost all goods and services are increasing. Inflation erodes the purchasing power of a currency. Inflation favors borrowers at the expense of lenders because when the borrower returns the principal to the lender, it is worth less in real terms, that is, in terms of goods and services, than it was worth when it was borrowed. Inflation that accelerates out of control is referred to as hyperinflation, which can destroy a country's monetary system and bring about social and political upheavals. The inflation rate is the percentage increase in the price level, typically compared to the prior year. Analysts can use the inflation rate as a business cycle indicator and to anticipate changes in central bank monetary policy. An objective of central banks is to keep inflation within some target range. Disinflation refers to an inflation rate that is decreasing over time, but remains greater than zero. A persistently decreasing price level, which results in a negative inflation rate, is called deflation. Deflation is commonly associated with deep recessions. When most prices are decreasing, consumers delay purchases because they believe they can buy the same goods more cheaply in the future. For firms, deflation results in decreasing revenue and increasing real fixed costs. The next LOS is to explain the construction of indices used to measure inflation. To calculate a rate of inflation, we need to use a price index as a proxy for the price level. A price index measures the average price for a defined basket of goods and services. The Consumer Price Index, or CPI, is the best-known indicator of U.S. inflation. Many countries use indexes similar to the CPI. The CPI basket represents the purchasing patterns of a typical urban household. To calculate the CPI, the Bureau of Labor Statistics compares the cost of the CPI basket today with the cost of the basket in an earlier base period. The value of the index is as follows. CPI equals the cost of the basket at current prices divided by the cost of the basket at base period prices times 100. Analysts who compare price indexes for different countries should be aware of differences in their composition. The weights assigned to each good and service reflect the typical consumer's purchasing patterns, which are likely to be significantly different across countries and regions. There can also be differences in how the data are collected. In the United States, for example, the most frequently cited CPI measure is based on the purchases typical of all urban consumers. Other countries may survey a different set of consumers and consequently use different baskets of goods. An alternative measure of consumer price inflation is the price index for personal consumption expenditures. In the United States, this index is created by surveying businesses rather than consumers. The GDP deflator, which we described in an earlier topic review, is another widely used inflation measure. Analysts who look for emerging trends in consumer prices are often interested in the prices of goods in process. Widespread price increases for producers' goods may be passed along to consumers. For most major economies, a producer price index or wholesale price index is available. Analysts can observe the producer price index for different stages of processing, raw materials, intermediate goods, and finished goods, to watch for emerging price pressure. Sub-indexes of the producer price index are also useful for identifying changes in relative prices of producers' inputs, which may indicate shifts in demand among industries. For both consumer and producer prices, analysts and policymakers often distinguish between headline inflation and core inflation. Headline inflation refers to price indexes for all goods. Core inflation refers to price indexes that exclude food and energy. Food and energy prices are typically more volatile than those of most other goods. Thus, core inflation can sometimes be a more useful measure of the underlying trend in prices. Our next LOS is to compare inflation measures, including their uses and limitations. A price index that uses a constant basket of goods and services is called a Lespère index. Most countries calculate consumer price inflation this way. Three factors cause a Lespère's index of consumer prices to be biased upward as a measure of the cost of living. New goods. Older products are often replaced by newer but initially more expensive products. New goods are periodically added to the market basket, and the older goods they replace are reduced in weight in the index. This biases the index upward. Quality changes. If the price of a product increases because the product has improved, the price increase is not due to inflation, but still increases the price index. Substitution. Even in an inflation-free economy, prices of goods relative to each other change all the time. When two goods are substitutes for each other, consumers increase their purchases of the relatively cheaper good and buy less of the relatively more expensive good. Over time, such changes can make a Lespère's index's fixed basket of goods a less accurate measure of typical household spending. A technique known as hedonic pricing can be used to adjust a price index for product quality. To address the bias from substitution, reporting agencies can use a chained or chain-weighted price index, such as a Fisher index. A Fisher index is the geometric mean of a Lespère's index and a Pasch index. A Pasch index uses the current consumption weights, prices from the base period, and prices in the current period. The next LOS is to distinguish between cost push and demand pull inflation. The two types of inflation are cost push and demand pull. Cost push inflation results from a decrease in aggregate supply, while demand pull inflation results from an increase in aggregate demand. Cost push inflation can result from an initial decrease in aggregate supply caused by an increase in the real price of an important factor of production, such as wages or energy. The reduction in short-run aggregate supply increases the price level and, with no initial change in aggregate demand, reduces output. If the decline in GDP brings a policy response that stimulates aggregate demand, so output returns to its long-run potential, the result would be a further increase in the price level. Because labor is the most important cost of production, wage pressure can be a source of cost-push inflation, sometimes called wage-push inflation, when this occurs. Upward pressure on wages is more likely to emerge when cyclical unemployment is low, but it can occur even when cyclical unemployment is present. Because every individual provides a different type and quality of labor, some segments of the economy may have trouble finding enough qualified workers, even during a contraction. As a result, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, also called the natural rate of unemployment, can be higher than the rate associated with the absence of cyclical unemployment. The natural rate can vary over time and is likely different across countries. Analysts can use publicly available data on hourly and weekly earnings and labor productivity to identify signs of potential wage pressure. Wage increases are not inflationary as long as they remain in line with gains in productivity. A useful indicator of wages and benefits in terms of productivity is unit labor costs, the ratio of total labor compensation per hour to output units per hour. An additional source of wage pressure is expected inflation. If workers expect inflation to increase, they will increase their wage demands accordingly. One indicator analysts use to gauge expected inflation is the difference in yield between inflation-indexed bonds, such as Treasury inflation-protected securities, and otherwise similar non-indexed Treasury bonds. Demand-pull inflation can result from an increase in the money supply, increased government spending, or any other change that increases aggregate demand. When the economy is at full employment and aggregate demand increases with no initial change in aggregate supply, output and the price level increase. Prices rise and real GDP is above potential or full employment GDP. With real GDP above its full employment level, the increase in GDP is not sustainable. Unemployment falls below its natural rate, which puts upward pressure on real wages. Rising real wages result in a decrease in short-run aggregate supply until real GDP reverts back to full employment GDP. Output falls back to its full employment level, and the price level increases further. In the absence of other changes, the economy would then reach a new equilibrium price level. But what would happen if the central bank tried to keep GDP above the full employment level with further increases in the money supply? The same results would occur repeatedly. Output cannot remain above its potential in the long run, but the induced increase in aggregate demand and the resulting pressure on wages would keep the price level rising even higher. Demand-pull inflation would persist until the central bank reduced the growth rate of the money supply and allowed the economy to return to full employment equilibrium at a level of real GDP equal to potential GDP. The impact on output is the key difference between the demand-pull and cost-push effects. The demand-pull effect increases GDP above full employment GDP, while with cost-push inflation, a decrease in aggregate supply initially decreases GDP. The last LOS for this topic review asks us to interpret economic indicators and describe their uses and limitations. Earlier in this topic review, we described the unemployment rate as a lagging indicator. Economic indicators can be classified into three categories: leading indicators that have been known to change direction before peaks and troughs in the business cycle, coincident indicators that change direction at roughly the same time as peaks and troughs, and lagging indicators that don't tend to change direction until after expansions or contractions are already underway. The Conference Board publishes indexes of leading, coincident, and lagging indicators for several countries. Their indexes for the United States include the following components. Leading indicators include average weekly hours in manufacturing, initial claims for unemployment insurance, manufacturers' new orders for consumer goods, manufacturers' new orders for non-defense capital goods ex aircraft, the Institute for Supply Management New Orders Index, building permits for new houses, the S&P 500 Equity Price Index, the Leading Credit Index, the 10-year Treasury to Fed Funds Interest Rate Spread, and consumer expectations. Coincident indicators include employees on non-farm payrolls, real personal income, the Index of Industrial Production, and manufacturing and trade sales. Lagging indicators include the average duration of unemployment, the inventory to sales ratio, the change in unit labor costs, the average prime lending rate, commercial and industrial loans, the ratio of consumer installment debt to income, and the change in the consumer price index. Other sources, such as the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development and the Economic Cycle Research Institute, also publish indexes of economic indicators for the world's major economies. Analysts should be aware that the classifications leading, coincident, and lagging indicators reflect tendencies in the timing of their turning points, not exact relationships with the business cycle. Not all changes in direction of leading indicator indexes have been followed by corresponding changes in the business cycle, and even when they have, the lead time has varied. This common criticism is summed up in the often repeated comment, "Declines in stock prices have predicted 9 of the last 4 recessions."